Chapter 6. Cale watched the face of the landlady as she looked him over. This decision was out of his hands. He actually thought of it as that, a decision. The question was, would she spot him as village? He couldn't be sure. Her expression, when she nodded, was enigmatic. The room she rented him was small, but it cost only a credit fourth a day. Cale lay down on the bed and relaxed by the rhythm system. He felt amazingly well. The theft of his money still stung, but it was no longer a disaster. The 15 credits the weapon shop girl had given him would tide him over for a few weeks. He was safe. He was in Imperial City. And the very fact that the girl had loaned him money and given him her name and address must prove something. Cale sighed with pleasure, finally, and went out to get some supper. He had noticed an automat at the corner. It was deserted except for a middle-aged man. Cale bought a steak from the instantaneous cooking machine and then deliberately sat down near the other diner. "I'm new here," he said conversationally. "Can you give me a picture of the city? I'd appreciate it." It was a new tack for him, admitting naivete, but he felt very sure of himself and very convinced that he needed data more than he needed to protect his own self-conscious pride. He was not too surprised when the stranger cleared his throat importantly and then said, "New to the big city, eh? Been anywhere yet?" "No, just arrived." The man nodded, half to himself, a faint gleam of interest in his gray eyes. Cale thought cynically, "He's wondering how he can take advantage of me." The other spoke again, his tone half ingratiating now. "My name is Gregor. I live just around the corner in a Skytel. What do you want to know?" "Oh," Cale spoke quickly, "where's the best residential district? Where's the business section? Who's being talked about?" Gregor laughed. "That last, the Empress, of course. Have you ever seen her?"
"Only on the stats."
"Well, you know then that she's just a kid trying hard to be tough." Cale knew nothing of the kind. Despite his cynicism, he had never thought of any member of the ruling family of Isher except in terms of their titles. Automatically, he rejected this man's attempt to make a human being out of Imperial Inelda. He said, "What about the Empress?" "They've got her trapped in the palace. A bunch of old men who don't want to give up power." Cale frowned, dissatisfied with the picture. He recalled the last time he had seen the Empress on the stats. It was a willful face, as he remembered it, and her voice had had in it great pride as well as determination. If any group was trying to use her as a tool, then they had better watch out. The young Empress had a mind of her own. Gregor said, "You'll want to try the games. That's on the Avenue of Luck. And then there's the theaters and the restaurants and..." Cale was losing interest. He should have known better than to expect that a casual acquaintance in a cheap residential district would be able to tell him what he wanted to know. This man had a small mind. What he had to say would not be important. The man was continuing, "I'll be very happy to take you around. I'm a little short myself right now, but..." Cale smiled wryly. So that was the extent of this man's machinations. It was part of the corrupt pattern of Isher life, but in this case such a mean and miserable part that it didn't matter. He shook his head and said gently, "I'll be happy to go out some other time. Tonight I'm kind of tired. You know, long trip, just got in." He applied himself to his food, not at all unhappy. The conversation had done him no harm. In fact, he felt slightly better. Without ever having been in Imperial City, he had a better idea than Gregor as to what was and what was not sensible. The meal cost more than he had expected, but even that he decided not to regret. After his experiences on the plane, he needed sustenance. He went out onto the street contentedly. The neighborhood swarmed with children, and though it was already dark, the play went on relentlessly. Cale paused for a moment to watch them. Their ages seemed to vary from about 6 to 12 years. Their play was of the group rhythm type taught in all the schools, only this was heavily overlaid with a sex motif that he had never seen before. He was startled, then rueful. "Good heavens," he thought. "I had the reputation for being a devil of a fellow. To these kids, I'd be just plain naive." He went up to his room, conscious that the young man over whom the elders of Glay had many times shaken their heads was really a simple, honest soul. He might come to a bad end, but it would be because he was too innocent, not the other way around. It disturbed him. In Glay, there had been a certain pleasure in defying the conventions. In Glay, he had thought of himself as being city. Lying on the bed, he knew that was true up to a point only. He lacked experience and knowledge, automatic response, and awareness of dangers. His immediate plans must include remedies for these weaknesses. The vagueness of the purpose disturbed him. He had an uneasy feeling that he was making stopgap decisions, that somehow he was not comprehending the main decision he must make one of these days. He drifted into sleep, worrying about it. Twice, when he stirred on the edge of wakening, the thought was still there, unpleasant, urgent, a jarring background to his first night in the city of dreams. He awoke tired and unhappy. Only gradually did the uneasiness wear off. He avoided the expensive automat, eating breakfast for a credit eighth in a restaurant that offered personal service and featured home cooking. He regretted his miserliness. The weight of the indigestible meal on his stomach did not lighten until he was in the Penny Palace, an ornate gambling establishment on the world-famous Avenue of Luck. According to a guidebook which dealt exclusively with the Avenue and its games, the Penny Palace owners have put up glitter signs which modestly claim that it is possible for anyone to come in with a penny and walk out with a million, meaning, of course, a million credits. Whether or not this good fortune has ever been achieved, the signs do not indicate. The write-up concluded generously, "The Penny Palace has the distinction of having more 50-50 games for the number of machines it has in operation than any other establishment on the Avenue of Luck." It was that plus the low stakes that interested Cale. His immediate plans did not include walking out with a million. He wanted 500 credits to begin with. After that, well, then he could afford to enlarge his horizon. He laid his first bet on a machine that pumped the words odd and even into a swirling pool of light. When 10 of each had been pumped into the pool, the liquid-looking stuff suffered a chemical change, after which it would support only one of the words on its surface. All the others sank through a screen and vanished. The winning words floated easily face up and somehow set in motion the paying mechanism or the collecting mechanism. The bettors either saw their bets vanish with a click, or else their winnings would slide automatically to the square before which they stood. Cale heard the click of defeat. He doubled his bet and this time won. He withdrew his original stake and played with the coin he had won. The intricate lights fused, the pump squished, then up floated the word even. The pleasant sound of money sliding softly toward him assailed Cale's ears. It was a sound that he was to hear often during the next hour and a half, for despite the fact that he played cautiously and only with pennies, he won just over 5 credits. Tired at last, he retreated to a connecting restaurant. When he came back into the treasure room, as it was called, he noticed a game that was played in an even more intimate fashion by the player himself. The money went into a slot, releasing a lever, and when this was pulled, a light sequence was set up. The movement was very rapid, but it resolved swiftly into red or black. The game was thus but another variation of the odd and even sequence, since the player had the same 50-50 chance of winning. Cale slipped a half-credit coin into the proper slot, pulled the activating lever, and lost. His second guess was equally wrong, and his third also. The fourth time, his color shimmered into place, and he had his first win. He won the next 10 straight, lost 4, then won 7 out of another 10 series. In 2 hours, by playing carefully, limiting his luck rather than forcing it, he won 78 credits. He withdrew to one of the bars for a drink and pondered his next move. So many things to do. Buy a new suit, protect his winnings, prepare for another night, and pay back the money Lucy Rawl had loaned him. His mind poised, titillated. He felt comfortable and very sure of himself. A moment later, he was putting through a stat call to the weapon shop girl. Making more money could wait. She came in almost immediately. "I'm out on the street now," she answered his request. Cale could see what she meant. Her face almost filled the screen. Extent stats magnified from a tiny image. People used them on the street, keeping them connected with their home stats. One of the fellows in Glay had one. Before Cale could speak, the girl said, "I'm on my way to my apartment. Wouldn't you like to meet me there?" Would he? Her apartment turned out to be a 4-room affair, unique only in the abundance of automatic devices. After a quick look around, it was clear to Cale that Lucy Rawl never did a stroke of housework. What puzzled him, however, was that the place seemed unprotected. The girl came out of her bedroom, dressed for the street, and shrugged at his comment.
"We weapon shop people," she said, "live just like anyone else, usually in the nicer residential districts. Only our shops and," she hesitated, "a few factories and, of course, the information center are protected from interference." She broke off. "You said something about buying a suit. If you wish, I'll help you select it. I've only 2 hours, though."
Cale held the door open for her, exhilarated. The invitation to her apartment must have a personal meaning. Whatever her duties for the weapon shops, they couldn't possibly include inviting obscure Cale Clark to her apartment, even if only for a few moments. He decided to assume that she was interested in him as an individual. They took a car plane, Lucy pushing the button that brought the machine down to pick them up.
"Where are we going?" Cale asked.
The girl smiled and shook her head.
"You'll see," she said.
When they were in the plane, she pointed up.
"Look," she said.
An artificial cloud was breaking out in the sky above. It changed color several times, then vividly through it shone the letters, "Haberdashery Paradise." Cale said,
"Why, I saw their ad last night."
He had forgotten, but now he remembered. The streamers of lights had soared aloft the night before as he walked from the automat to his rooming house, advertising paradise, informing males of every age that here was the place to buy, here the retail establishment that could furnish anything in men's clothing any hour of the day or night, anywhere on Earth, Mars, or Venus, and for a trifling extra cost, anywhere in the inhabited solar system. The ad had been one of hundreds, and so, in spite of his need for clothes, the name didn't remain in his memory.
"It's a store worth seeing," Lucy said.
It seemed to Cale that she was enjoying his enjoyment. It made him feel a little naive, but not too much. What was important was that she was going with him. He ventured,
"It's so kind of you to help me."
Haberdashery Paradise turned out to be more impressive than its ads. The building was 3 blocks long and 80 stories high. So Lucy told him and added,
"We'll go to the main sections quickly, then buy your suit."
The entrance to Paradise was 100 yards wide and 30 stories high. An energy screen kept the weather out, but its doorless vastness was otherwise without barriers. It was easy to press through the harmless screen into the domed anteroom. The Paradise not only supplied beach clothing, it supplied a beach with a quarter of a mile of surging water tumbling from a misty horizon onto the rich, tangy smell of the sea itself. Paradise not only supplied ski outfits, it supplied startlingly lifelike mountains with a twisting half mile of snow-covered slope. "Paradise is a complete store," said one flashing sign to which Lucy called his attention. "If there is anything you do not see that fits in with our slogan, everything for the man, ask for it. We have it at a price."
"That includes women," Lucy said matter-of-factly. "They charge the same for women as they do for their suits, anywhere from 5 credits to 50,000. You'd be surprised how many women of good family register when they need money. It's all very discreet, of course."
Cale saw that she was looking at him thoughtfully, and that he was expected to make a comment. It was so direct that he was startled. He said hastily,
"I shall never pay money for a woman."
It seemed to satisfy her, for they went from there to the suits. There were 30 floors of suits, but each floor had its own price range. Lucy took him to the 20-30-credit floor and pointed out to him the difference in weave between city cloth and the cloth of his own suit. For 32 credits, he bought a suit, tie, socks, and shoes.
"I don't think," said Lucy practically, "you should go any higher than that yet."
She refused his offer of the credits he owed her.
"You can pay me that later on. I'd rather you put it in the bank now as a reserve fund."
It meant he would see her again. It seemed to mean she wanted to see him again.
"Better hurry and change," said Lucy. "I'll wait."
It was that decided him to try to kiss her before they separated. But when he came out, her first words dashed this determination.
"I didn't realize how late it was," she said. "It's 3 o'clock.
She paused to look at him, smiled.
"You're a big, strong, handsome man," she said. "Did you know? But now let's hurry."
They separated at the gargantuan entrance, Lucy hurrying to a car plane stop,
leaving him empty behind her. The feeling departed slowly. He began to walk at a quickening pace. By the time he came to where the Fifth Interplanetary Bank sat heavily on the base from which its ethereal spire soared to a height of 64 stories, ambition was surging in him again. It was a big bank in which to deposit the tiny sum of 15 credits, but the money was accepted without comment, though he was required to register his fingerprints. Cale left the bank, more relaxed than he had been at any time since the robbery. He had a savings account. He was suitably dressed. There remained one more thing before he proceeded to the third phase of his gambling career. From one of the public car planes, he had located the all-directional sign of a weapon shop, nestling in its private park near the bank. He walked briskly up the beflowered pathway, and he was almost at the door when he noticed the small sign, which he had never seen before in a weapon shop. The sign read, "All Metropolitan Weapon Shops Temporarily Closed. New and old rural shops open as usual." Cale retreated reluctantly. It was one possibility he had not expected, the fabulous weapon shops being closed. He turned as a thought came, but there was no indication as to when the shops would reopen. No date, nothing at all but the one simple announcement. He stood frowning, experiencing a sense of loss, shocked by the silence. Not, he realized, that that blast should be bothering him. In Glay, it was always silent around the weapon shop. The feeling of personal loss, the what-ought-he-to-do-now bewilderment grew. On impulse, he tried the door. It was solid and immovable. His second retreat began, and this time he carried through to the street. He stood on a safety aisle, undecided as to what button to push. He thought back over the 2.5 hours with Lucy, and it seemed a curious event in space-time. He felt appalled, remembering how drab his conversation had been. And yet, except for a certain directness, a greater decisiveness, her own conversation left no dazzling memories. "This is it," he thought. "When a girl puts up with a dull fellow for an afternoon, she's felt something." The pressures inside him grew stronger, the will to action telescoping his plans, impelling him to swift activity. He had thought, weapon shop, more gambling, then Army District Headquarters commanded by Colonel Medlin, over a period of a week. The weapon shop had to be first, because weapon shops did not open for Imperial agents, whether soldiers or merely government employees. But he couldn't wait for that now. He pressed the button that would bring down the first car plane going toward District Number 19. A minute later, he was on his way.